Welcome to Roleplaying History, the podcast where we explore the history of role-playing games. I'm Wayne Davis, and I'll be your guide for today's tour. Episode 140, Top Secret and Krasimov's World. Okay, so after the goat rope we ran into last week, I'm rested, reloaded, caffeinated, and ready to go. And for those curious why I'd say it that way, well, in my opinion, that's the geek version of tanned, rested, and ready. Since let's be honest, we geeks tend to not tan since I don't think we see a whole hell of a lot of sun. Or at least I don't. Maybe I shouldn't speak for the geek culture as a whole. Anyway, let's get the tour bus cranked up and get to the first topic on this week's tour. And I know we've covered the first subject on this week's tour a little bit on the podcast in the past, as we hit on it way back when we were doing the timelines back in the early parts of the show, but we haven't covered it in full since we've been doing the full-length shows on games, so let's get into Top Secret. Top Secret was designed by Merle M. Rasmussen for TSR, who released it in 1980. Top Secret was an espionage-themed game, and it gave GMs and players the opportunity to build and play their own espionage-themed stories. The initial release of the game was, as were most TSR releases at the time, regardless of the game and system, a boxed set that included a 64-page rulebook, along with a sample adventure titled Operation Spreckenhostel. I know I screwed that one up. For a bit more background history on the development of Top Secret, we do know that it was developed over a period of about 2 years by Rasmussen and TSR editor Alan Hammack, and according to reports, they managed to get themselves in a bit of trouble with the FBI. It seems that during playtesting, a note about an imaginary assassination plot that was written on official TSR stationery resulted in the FBI investigating the TSR Hobbies office. So, at least the playtest materials were well written enough to seem real to the feds anyway. Sounds like a good start to me. 1 year after the initial release, TSR released the second edition of Top Secret, and that would be the final release of this version of the game. And I say it that way because 6 years later, there would be a new version of the game. But we'll get to that a little later on, and I'm changing my usual methodology because there's enough of a difference between the versions that I want to cover them separately this week. I'm just experimenting with another way of doing things. Since we know Top Secret is an espionage game, I don't think we need to explain that. Instead, let's break down what makes the game tick. D10s are the dice used for the game, and all character attributes and other stats are percentiles. Now, when you get into character creation, some of those scores would be rolled, but others would have been derived from combinations of two or more of the scores that have already been rolled, and that would have been explained in the text as you went along. And for the record, that wasn't too much different from some of the games of the time. Certain scores for characters could come from adding a couple of previously generated scores together. So, this wasn't an entirely new concept. It was one of the first times it was used to quite this large an extent, but not the first time it had been used. I just wanted to clarify here. Top Secret also featured something called Areas of Knowledge. Now, these functioned a lot like what we call skills in today's games. Other things in the character area included the ability to gain experience points and gaining levels, which at the time was the standard, and for the most part, it was the only way to advance and improve characters. Now, one thing to know about this is that the levels did have a rather limited in-game effect, mostly due to the fact that the gained XP were divided by the character's level, but the base mission pay was multiplied by the character's level. So, basically, it was a better deal in cash for the spy than it was in experience. However, characters could improve their statistics by spending those experience points once they had enough of them to do so. Top Secret was also one of the first games to have a mechanic known as fame and fortune points. These points allowed for players to alter game results. Now, We still have these in some games today, and they're seen most often in the various storytelling games such as Fate. So we looked a bit into the characters. Now, once been drawn up, what the hell do we do with it? I'm glad you asked. Okay, I know you didn't ask, so I'm glad I asked. The characters in Top Secret are employed in one of three specific bureaus: assassination, confiscation, or investigation. Each of those bureaus are part of an unspecified espionage agency. Now, each character has their primary vocation, but it's possible for them to be called to perform whatever kind of mission they're needed for. However, if they're fortunate enough to be performing a mission within their bureau, they could pick up 100 bonus experience points. There was an appendix in the rulebook with a list of a dozen of both historical and fictional espionage organizations that the GM could use for employers or adversaries for missions in the game. The Top Secret Companion, written by Merle Rasmussen and released in 1985, added some goodies to the game. It added some character classes, more missions, additional areas of knowledge, more abilities, a revised combat system, and it sped up and provided more variety to combat results. It also added new equipment and weapons. In other words, it was damn near another revised edition. Now, normally I wouldn't get into the level of detail I'm about to get into concerning the supplements that came out for Top Secret, but as I researched the game, I found out that these first two editions have a rarity level that's high enough that if you just happen to have some of this stuff, you're sitting on some gold there. So I thought I might do a public service on the show here by taking the time to mention them. So I mentioned the companion and the first module, so I'm not going to repeat them here. 1982 was a big year for Top Secret related product. The Top Secret Administrator screen and MIDI module made its way out. Oh, did I mention that the GM in Top Secret was the administrator? Sorry about that. Should have put it out there earlier. So, obviously, this was the Top Secret version of the GM screen. It also came with its own mission, Operation Executive One. Corey Kobernick was the designer for this release. Mike Carr wrote two missions that came out in 82, Operation Rapid Strike and Lady in Distress. Rapid Strike involved a commando raid on an enemy complex to recover a kidnapped scientist, while Lady in Distress involved agents parasailing to rescue a hijacked cruise ship. 1983 was also a good year for Top Secret releases. First up was the Agent Dossiers. Granted, these were just printed character sheets, but still, it beats having to copy the sheets out of the book. Philip Tatarzynski wrote Operation Fast Pass, which covered a defection at an international puzzle tournament being held behind the Iron Curtain. And if that sounds like an odd type of situation, you have to remember how things worked during the Cold War. And if you're too young to know that time in world history, you need to do a little history dive after today's podcast. David Cook stepped up and wrote Operation Orient Express. This module was a bit different from what came before and what would follow, as it was a series of six adventures set on trains in Europe, and it also provided rules for creating similar adventures of your own. From there, the first two editions of Top Secret got two more official supplement releases. Merle Rasmussen wrote 1984's Operation Ace of Clubs. This one had the agents investigating events at the Ace of Clubs, which is an exclusive resort and casino operated as a front by the agency. Finally, 1985 saw Evan Robinson's Operation Seventh Seal. Our beloved agents have to deal with a nuclear threat from an organization that uses tarot cards as code names. And while these were the only commercially released adventures, six adventures saw release in Dragon Magazine between 1981 and 1984, and Merle Rasmussen even published one for these editions in Gygax Magazine in 2014. Now, normally I'd get into reviews at this point, but I'm not going to do that because I'm not done covering editions of the game just yet. I've still got two versions to cover. In 1987, TSR decided it was time for another edition. And not only was it a revision, but it got a name adjustment as well. Top Secret / SI, the SI stands for Special Intelligence, was designed by Douglas Niles and it released as a boxed set. The idea behind the revision was to provide a more structured gaming environment for the top secret system than the original two editions of the system had given. In this new version, the players played characters who were specifically agents working for the secret intelligence agency Orion in their fight against their evil adversary, Webb. Later on in the series, Top Secret got supernatural with the introduction of Agent 13 and futuristic with the Freelancers setting. When those came out, we got some memorable recurring characters like Sebastian Cord and Agent 13. The Top Secret brand officially stopped production in 1992, and even though reports have come up over the past 25 years or so about various TSR products being brought back by Wizards of the Coast, Top Secret has never been one of them. But I've got a piece of news about that coming up in a bit, so don't write it off just yet. Now, I've mentioned that SI is basically a complete overhaul, so to go over all of the differences would basically be a podcast of its own, so I'm not going to cover all of it. I did want to cover a couple of them, though, so let's get into it. The character sheets are the first ones, and they obviously had to adjust them to take advantage of the streamlined rules. They're similar to the sheets from the original editions in that they're created to look like agent dossiers. However, in this version, they're set up to be a handy-dandy easy reference document to get to all the relevant stats and skills, which makes it easy to get to everything you need when sneaking, fighting, and doing all that agency shit you need to do. The combat system was a pretty big deal in this version, and it was the major thing that pretty much every site I found online spent the majority of its space talking about. So I'm going to spend the majority of my time on this edition talking about it. I mean, it only seems fair. The combat system was touted by TSR as being a fast, simple, unified combat system, which most players at the time agreed with. And what made it so is the fact that it was based on a percentile roll. And again, I should have mentioned this when I was talking about the original edition a moment ago, but I felt like it fit better here. The reason why the new combat system felt better here is because the original combat system was a bit bulkier. There were two different styles. The percentile rolls were for projectile combat only. If you were doing hand-to-hand combat, you used rock, paper, scissors. I mean, I suppose you could do it now and make it really hard by doing rock, paper, scissors, lizard, Spock. I had to put a Big Bang Theory reference in there because I don't know when I'll get another chance. I'm sorry. Anyway, for SI, combat was divided into 5-second rounds. If it was determined to be necessary, rounds could be further divided into 1-second phases. In each round, weapon possession was resolved first, then hand-to-hand combat. In each phase, character movement followed projectile combat, and characters could move up to 15 feet per phase. When it comes to firing order, that's determined by each weapon's speed and 5 categories of 28 condition modifiers, drawing, shooter's movement, wounds, aiming, and surprise factor being among them. For projectile combat, a character's stats, skills, bonuses, and penalties, their projectile weapon's properties, and the current combat conditions give the character a percentile chance of hitting a target. For each projectile fired, the shooting player rolls 2 10-sided dice to give a number from 1 to 100, and since we all know how the percentile system works, I'm not going to insult your intelligence here. The shooting player rolls again to determine the hit location, then the shooter rolls again to determine the damage for each success. With a damage roll, the first die determines the type of wound, and the second determines the seriousness, and there's a chart that gives the type for each of those. For hand-to-hand combat, each combatant in each round chooses from 7 combat types, and those are weapon possession, untrained, knife fighting, boxing, swordplay, judo, and martial arts. Each combat type allows the players to choose from a total of up to 3 attacks and defenses, and that's combined. A combatant may only choose a combat type allowed by their physical education or military science knowledge level. Each combatant secretly chooses their attacks and defenses from their preferred combat type for that round, then the combatants simultaneously reveal their choices. The GM interprets the attack and defense choices, looks up the results on the attack combat types table, and modifies the result by any object used as a hand-to-hand weapon. On the martial arts table alone, there are 28 attack choices and 15 defense choices. So, there was a lot of stuff that got changed when Top Secret SI came along, and TSR spared no expense in dropping support for it. And while I spent a lot of time getting into the details on the support material for the first two editions, I'm not going to do that here. And that's because the stuff for the third edition isn't worth nearly as much as the other stuff is, and I'm sorry about that. What I will say is that there were two box sets, 7 accessory books, 9 mission modules, 2 solo casebooks, a module published in Dungeon Magazine, 7 novels published that were based on various campaigns, 2 graphic novels based on Agent 13, as well as an 8-issue comic line based on Agent 13, and the Top Secret SI game got a 4-issue comic series of its own. So, TSR spent a lot of time and a lot of money doing everything it could to get the Top Secret SI line out to the masses. And to be honest, it worked. Top Secret SI sold well, and it sold well for quite some time. TSR didn't necessarily shut it down due to poor sales. They ultimately shut it down because it didn't sell as well as D&D did. But then again, what did? Now, I mentioned a couple of minutes ago that while TSR gave up on Top Secret back in 1992, it's not gone forever. And here's why. In June of 2017, the creator of the original Top Secret, Merle Rasmussen, announced he was bringing it back. He decided to reboot his creation as Top Secret New World Order and decided to bring it back as a new take on the old favorite. He reported to the world what a fortunate few had already known. He'd been running the game in his new old version at conventions for around 2 years and had been adjusting the rules and user experience in real time in response to the experience. The result was an updated rule system that he promised would appeal to the role player of the modern era. And in a sign of the time, Rasmussen decided to fund the game with a Kickstarter, which went live on June 27th of 2017. As one would expect from a game so beloved by so many, it more than exceeded its goal and began shipping to its backers in March of 2018. Now, I attempted to find feedback on this version of the game online, and while we all know how deep the rabbit hole of the internet can go, I didn't have a lot of luck finding any meaningful information about this version, so this is where I'm enlisting your help. If you've got a copy of this version of the game, I want to hear from you. Hit me up on the socials or on email, and I want to hear all about it. With your permission, of course, and I would love to share your thoughts with our listeners. All right, so now it's time to drop in a couple of reviews. Jerry Epperson reviewed the first edition of Top Secret for the July 1980 issue of Space Gamer. Here's what he had to say, quote, "I liked the game, despite its faults. The system is new enough that the situations will not become blasé, as with other role-playing games, for months or years. And it would be a sound investment for any fans of the James Bond, Executioner, or Avenger stories. Others would be wise to stick with fantasy if they cannot associate with the heroes of the present." End quote. I've got 2 from Rick Swan, and they both come from his 1990 book, The Complete Guide to Role-Playing Games. The first is his assessment of the first edition of the game. He calls it, quote, "the first espionage RPG of any consequence," end quote. And he says it, quote, "holds up amazingly well even a decade after its release," end quote. The second review is of Top Secret SI. He liked it even more than the original and called it, quote, "not only an improvement in every respect, it's also the best espionage RPG on the market, a masterful integration of elegant mechanics, evocative atmosphere, and sleek graphics," end quote. One final review, and it's kind of obligatory when a game shows up on this particular poll. Top Secret showed up at number 38 on the 1996 Arcane Magazine reader poll of the top 50 role-playing games of all time. Paul Pettengill said, quote, "Top Secret is inspired more by The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and the lighter James Bond movies than real life. Players belong to an organization of good guys pitted against bad guys, a thinly veiled analogy of the Eastern Bloc. Gadgets and manners are more important than combat skills, and there are rarely nasty deaths," end quote. I think I'll wrap up this part of the show by saying this. I checked out a lot of message boards and fan sites for Top Secret when I was researching for this show, and I can tell you this. If you're looking for an espionage game to run your group through for a couple of game nights, get your hands on Top Secret. This isn't a game you're going to want to run for months or years, but it's definitely something you're going to want to keep on hand as that bridge game to run between long-running campaigns or for that game to run when you want a change of pace. Definitely worth the price. All right, so I announced two topics for this week, and I noted that the second topic was one that the majority of you had probably never heard of. Well, let's remedy that. Krasimov's World was a play-by-mail game that was first developed by Kevin Cropper in 1980 and is regarded by most as the first fantasy role-playing play-by-mail game. And before you come at me with the torches, I've covered play-by-mail before, so I consider it to be a valid topic for this show. As a matter of fact, I think we need to be covering it more on this show. So, for you old schoolers who cut your teeth on play-by-mail, hit me up with more games to research. I'm digging them up, but I'm looking for more. You know where to find me. Right now, though, the floor belongs to Krasimov's World, so let me use that history teacher's certificate I've got and give you a little history lesson. In the 1970s, play-by-mail had become an exceptionally popular method of playing games in the UK for games like chess and diplomacy. In 1980, Kevin Cropper came up with an idea. He took his long-running Dungeons & Dragons campaign, which he dubbed Krasimov's World, and redesigned it into a postal game. His idea was that he'd moderate the game by replying to each player's action with a handwritten response. He advertised the game in White Dwarf. That advertisement worked so well that he left his job in order to spend all of his time running the campaign. It required him to found the company KJC Games to be the parent company for the game. By the way, I know claiming that Krasimov's World was the first play-by-mail fantasy game is a bold statement, but it's not my statement. That statement comes from Michelle Nephew, who made the argument in the dissertation she did in 2003 for the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee titled Playing with Power, the Authorial Consequence of Role-Playing Games. So if you disagree, take it up with her. Though I'd argue she's a hell of a lot smarter than I am, so I'm going to go with her on this one. Anyway, by 1984, Cropper had 450 regular players, and that was way beyond his ability to manage on his own. And since he wanted to be able to focus on managing the games store he had in Cleveley's, I hope I got that right, he hired two full-time games masters, Nigel Mitchell and Andy Smith. The game continued to grow from there, so in June of 1985, they added another, Andy Hume. All three continued to provide handwritten responses to each player's turn and published a regular newsletter for the players. And for a time, the game was so popular, Cropper hired a part-time staff member whose sole job was to help new players with their startups. For those who understand anything about the history of play-by-mail, that should tell you just how popular this game really was. From time to time, KJC Games also hosted what they called Krasimeets, which were conventions where the players could meet face-to-face with Mitchell, Smith, and Hume to play the traditional pencil-and-paper game sessions. It was at the earliest of these sessions that the GMs picked up god nicknames, with Mitchell being referred to as Le Denon, Smith, Fenor, and Hume, Tigellin. KJC Games eventually licensed the U.S. rights to the game to Jack Everett of Adventures by Mail, who developed an American version of the game, which also turned out to be exceptionally popular. In 1987, KJC Games licensed Krasimov's World to Andy Smith, who created the company Krasaworld. A few years after that, Krasaworld converted the game to a computer-moderated game using the Quest PMG engine. And thanks to having several other PMB games in their portfolio, Krasaworld was able to keep Krasimov's World up and running until 2004. That's the history lesson, but thanks to the internet, I've been able to dig up a bit more about how the game worked, so let me share what I know. In the original version of the game, when Kevin Cropper was the moderator, Players paid £2.50 for the rulebook, then selected a cast of 9 characters who were either priests, fighters, or mages, and they gave the group a name. Cropper would then place the new band of adventurers somewhere in his campaign world and send the new player a letter that described their starting location, as well as campaign news, recent events in the new group's locality, and some rumors. The player would then respond with what they wanted their party to do, including which direction the party was traveling, trades or purchasing, possible actions if encountered by hostiles, and any special instructions or requests. Cropper would then send further information and updates, and the player would respond with their next turn. Each turn cost £1.25. By the way, I hope I'm saying British money correctly. I'm used to doing American cash, so I looked it up. If I screwed that up, I apologize. If one party wandered into an area already inhabited by another player's party, Cropper would give each player the other's contact information, with permission, of course, so the players could confer directly to share information. When Krazaworld changed moderation from human to computer, the number of starting party members was reduced from 9 to 6, but the new player could now choose from 4 professions as well as 4 races, humans, dwarves, elves, and half-breeds for each member of the party. I've got a couple of reviews to share. Trevor Graver reviewed Krasimov's World for White Dwarf in January of 1983 and was impressed. He wrote, quote, "The effort the game master puts into each turn never ceases to amaze me. Most players find themselves offered a different scenario each turn or find that a new twist has happened to an existing adventure," end quote. He concluded by stating, quote, "It's easy to play and reflects the amount of effort you are prepared to put into your moves," end quote. Brian Kreese reviewed it in May of 1984 for the Chainmail section of Imagine magazine and stated simply, quote, "One nice feature of this game is that I have already made contact with another player after only a few moves," end quote. And at the 1985 Origins Award, Krasimov's World was a finalist for Best Play-by-Mail Game of 1984. It lost out to StarWeb. Like I said last week when I announced we'd be covering Krasimov's World this week, I stumbled onto it when I was researching something else, and I'm glad I did. When I can find games like this that a lot of the gaming world has forgotten about, I appreciate the opportunity to bring them back out and bring them to you because, if I'm honest, that's what I started this show to do. And honestly, I'd have loved to play this game. So with that, we've come to the end of today's tour. And I want to say this again, if you're an old school play-by-mail player who's got a game you'd like to hear me deep dive on this show, let me know about it by email or on the socials, and I will cover it on this show. As a matter of fact, I would love to stack a month or so of shows up with these, because I know there were a ton of them over the years that a whole bunch of people played and loved. And that invite doesn't just go out to the play-by-mail games, by the way. I throw that out there for any role-playing game. I've still got a list a mile long, but if you have something you want me to deep dive, let me know and I will put that on the top of the list. Or at least as far up on the list as I can when you take into account the amount of research I need to do to make sure it can make this show. Next week, I'm going to get knee-deep into the Fantasy Trip. And I mean a legit game called Fantasy Trip. Not like a weed trip or anything like that. Even though it's legal in my state, I don't smoke it. Anyway, in the meantime, check out Bad GM's campaign build along. This week, I'm doing what I punted on last week and narrowing the focus on our build to getting the setting built for our starting location so we can start building some scenario in the next week or so. Bad GM's campaign build along is available wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, badgmproductions.net. The theme for role-playing history is Beyond New Horizons by Gioli Fazeri and is available from pixabay.com. Role-playing history is a production of Bad GM Productions. We've got a presence all over social media, so check out the info box for this episode or the website to see where you can follow us. And make sure you do so you can keep up with what we're doing or so that you can let us know what you would like to see us do on this show in the future. Next week, we head up on a trip. No, I'm sorry, that's not right. We cover the Fantasy Trip. Until then, I'm Wayne Davis, and you're role-playing history.